This is WBCRLP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org. We're Farm and Garden Show hosts Bill Taylor and Jay Allison Moscariello. For upcoming events, like the farmers markets, you can visit berkshiregrown.org for a list of markets in Berkshire County and nearby Columbia County. Nigel Palmer is an author, educator, and experimental gardener. He is an instructor for the gardening portion of the Holistic Health Education Program at the Institute of Sustainable Nutrition, a school founded by his wife, Joan Palmer. After realizing that growing nutrient-dense food is a health program in itself, he researched materials exploring the wisdom of indigenous people on how to work with nature to grow delicious, nutritious food. His research culminated in the writing of the book, The Regenerative Grower's Guide to Garden Amendments.
Welcome, Nigel, author of The Regenerative Grower's Guide to Garden Amendments. How did you start the practice of creating biological and mineral extracts and ferments? And how does your former career as an aerospace engineer bring science to and inform your garden practices? This is a big question.
Broad and different questions. So how did I start?
Yeah.
I started learning about regenerative agriculture and recognizing that the food that we ate was the best medicine that we could have. It was somewhere in our 40s that we recognized that the American healthcare system really did not focus on preventative ideas. And with not much effort, we realized that the food we eat is the best preventative medicine there was. And so we really recognized that not only growing our own food, but growing our own nutrient-rich food was the way to go. And I've never bought anything in a store. Even when I was a kid with a garden, it was always cow manure and rotill it in, and that was pretty well it. It's often referred to as organic by neglect. And so I started looking around for alternatives. And the first thing that came to light was the idea of putting weeds in a bucket of rainwater and letting it sit and then feeding that to my plants. And that really smelled absolutely horrid after about 2 weeks. And so some other ideas needed to come forward. And I found a book on Korean natural farming written by Master Cho, which listed some of the recipes that are in my book. That really flipped me on my head. And that's a nice lead into my engineering background. When I started making the mineral and biological amendments that were listed, I thought to myself, well, I've learned that there are 18 minerals that are needed. I wonder what's in these amendments. And so I decided to do some analysis of those amendments. And when I did so, I looked around for many labs. I spent an awful lot of money on various labs trying to find one that would give me a relatively simple test at a reasonable price, and found one because I wanted to start accruing this data so that other people could use it. And of course, consistency, if you want to eliminate sources of variation, a single lab is the way to go. Anyway, so I started analyzing these things, and lo and behold, I found that all of those 18 minerals were in the amendments that I was making. And furthermore, I found that there were concentrations of some trace minerals, like in fruits, for instance, and that made it clear to me that, guess what? This is why we need to eat all these fruits and vegetables, is because the minerals that we need are actually in them as seen by the analysis. And so it really gave full circle to the idea of, where do you find these 18 minerals? The food we eat has those minerals. And then you can take it a step further and say, well, it's got to be in the soil, right? And so you need the soil and the biology and the ecosystem in order to get that food that we need for our health. So that's kind of a roundabout way of starting it. We need a healthcare program, and growing our own food is the way to do it.
I'm wondering what lab you use for measuring the extracts in making these various products, which we're going to talk about. Do you measure the liquid? Do you dry it and send it in? How do you standardize the way that you test these amendments?
Yeah, it's a liquid. And when you make these mineral amendments, you strain them and you end up with a liquid. And I send that liquid into Logan Labs, and they have a standardized process of measuring the 18 different minerals that I've spelled out for that. And you can contact Logan Lab directly, and they'll do the analysis for you. Or you can look at my website, which has not only the analysis that people can review for free, but it also has the forms that you may want to use for not only a soil analysis, but also the mineral analysis that we're talking about. It's a nice standardized methodology.
Great. What do you think the benefits are of doing this versus using fertilizers or purchased amendments?
The benefits are vast and long listed, and some more subtle than others. I guess the first thing is that these things really work. They are the things that plants want because they're made from plants and they're in forms that plants can use directly. They're water soluble, they're shelf stable. So there's the actual usage portion of it. The next thing is that they're low cost or free. When you consider using leaf mold biology and rainwater and the plants that are growing around your garden as sources, you may have to buy organic apple cider vinegar, which you can also make yourself. And the other purchasing item is organic brown sugar, which you can purchase in this part of the world relatively easily. The ingredients that we're using often are not only free, but also close the waste gaps. When you consider using oyster shells from a local restaurant or fish parts, if you happen to live near the ocean or have a fish market nearby, or the bones from the bone broth that you've made in the wintertime and you would otherwise maybe throw in the compost pile, or the eggshells. So there's a lot of closing of waste gaps as well. These are truly sustainable ideas rather than the buzzword sustainable ideas. And then not supporting the chemical industries that are polluting much of our land. Many of the products that people purchase in the box stores are nothing more than toxins that we spread throughout the land. And home gardeners are some of the biggest polluters around in purchasing some of these products. So in that regard, we're no longer poisoning the land around us with some of these products. And then finally, we're not using the plastics for packaging or the oil or the gas for transportation. There's a huge web of benefits here. And I guess the word that can mostly sum all of that together is sustainability. These ideas are truly sustainable, and that's really important to us.
I love the introduction of the book by Joan, because for me, it brought everything that we were about to read together in this one wonderful idea. Why are we doing this? Because we want to be healthier, because this is the right thing to do. And I just wanted to mention that it's just a beautiful, beautiful opening to have your mind just expand to everything that you're about to reveal.
And this book we're talking about is Regenerative Grower's Guide to Garden Amendments, Using Locally Sourced Materials to Make Mineral and Biological Extracts and Ferments by Nigel Palmer.
Foreword by John Kemp.
So what changes do you notice after using the ferments and extracts? You can do foliar feeding or you can do soil drenching. How does each of those work?
Yeah, well, just a word about the foreword that Joan wrote. Joan really is a pioneer in our local area, for me anyway, in these kinds of ideas. It's her education and work, and it's her lifestyle that has launched us down this road. Her school, the Institute of Sustainable Nutrition, offers a glimpse into not just food as medicine, but also the ideas of kitchen medicine, where you use plants, make tinctures, and many other aspects of a healthcare program, whether it be using clean products in your home rather than some of the toxic chemicals in shampoos and soaps and cleaning products in the house. Joan is just an amazing, not only resource, but initiator of these wonderful ideas. And I'm so grateful that she's pushed us down this road. Yeah, Joan has a school called the Institute of Sustainable Nutrition, and she offers a one-year program. It's been reformatted this year, but it's starting off in September. I think there's four classes and then again in the spring. And it tries to bring together the garden, the food, the lifestyle, all of the products that one may have made 200 or 300 years ago in order to maintain that health, not only the health of ingesting food, but also the health of the products that are used around. I think that it's really an amazing program. I happen to teach the garden portion of the program. It's really divided up into four ideas: the science of nutrition, and we're talking real nutrition. I mean, why is food so difficult? Why is the idea of what you eat so difficult? Kitchen medicine, I think I briefly touched on that, where we talk about making sauerkraut and bone broths and tinctures for health, elixirs. And then there's a cooking portion of the program where we actually harvest from the garden and make meals with it. And then the garden portion, which I teach. And so that's a really cool program. And I offer programs online. I found my reach to be rather international. And so I offer a program online. I do that once a year. And I also offer conversations with people that have gone through my program where we talk about successes and failures. And that's been a really, really fun program because it brings students back into a forum of open conversation where we share ideas and we share successes and what works and what doesn't work. It's a really fun, fun program. And then I also have a YouTube channel. I don't know what the station is, but you can get it from my website.
And your classes, the four session classes, are they located in West Granby or are they online or both?
The Jones program is strictly in person. It's a very, very small group of people, about 10, 12 people. It's all at our home. So we're in our gardens, in our kitchen, working with the plants and resources that we use on a regular basis. So you're really getting a firsthand experience of what we do here, which is kind of fun.
And that's Northern Connecticut, if people are thinking geographically. What changes you notice after using the ferments?
The ferments is just one aspect of a sustainable regenerative program. And the nice thing about the ferments and foliar spraying is it offers a way to feed not only plants, but also the soil biology in real time so that you can affect the situation today, now. But it really starts with the soil and the whole idea of regenerating the soil. And the biggest thing about regenerating the soil is making the soil have tilth, have airiness, have minerals, and have carbon. Carbon is the biggest deal associated with the whole growing experience. And how do you get carbon into the soil? Not only the carbon on the top of the surface of the soil that's breaking down and feeding the active layers of the soil up top, but also moving that carbon down deep into the soil. And that is occurring by the roots that actually penetrate down deep into the soil and degrade. There's two ways that the soil deep gets carbon. One is the root exudates from those roots that are deep in the soil. And two is from the deterioration of those roots once those plants die. So it's a multiple prong approach. There's long and short term strategies associated with this, but the changes are profound. It changes the whole ecosystem. It wasn't long after starting down this path that I recognized, well, why am I just focusing on these gardens plots? Why wouldn't I be focusing on my entire landscape? Right? Why wouldn't I feed everything? And why wouldn't I approach these same principles through my entire yard, if you will? And by doing so, we have changed the entire ecosystem. We have snakes and toads and frogs. You know those little red nymph salamanders?
Yes.
I see those walking across the middle of my lawn now. And I the butterfly, the ecosystem has changed. The birds that are here have changed. Things like ticks, right? I don't have ticks in my lawn anymore for the most part because I have the frogs and the toads that are eating them. And so by generating all of these things and not using chemicals to kill, right, we are invigorating the ecosystem and we see the results. There's nothing I like more than sitting on the south deck watching the gardens at the end of the day and seeing the birds taking out all the moths, just watching the insect predators do their job or watching the amazing variety and number of pollinators all over the flowers, the owls that come in. So we've got bobcats and fisher cats and coyotes and bear. In fact, last fall, the garden predator that took out my beans was a moose. So we've changed the ecosystem and we continue to cause that ecosystem to flourish.
Wonderful.
That's so amazing because I think I shared with you and Joan when we met you, privileged to be able to see Nigel and Joan's farm and their operation. And it's gorgeous. It has me mindful of just what you're just talking about is the first couple of years we were here, Bill started allowing meadows in the back. I was all concerned about what will the neighbors think about the front. I'm keeping everything tucked and neat, looking like a velvet landscape. And then after I saw everything that was teeming life in the back, I just said, okay, Bill, just letting it loose in the front.
And we just mow paths to get
and we mow paths. But just exactly what you're saying, there's a decrease in the tick population quite significantly. There's more toads and frogs and all these lovely creatures. And it's like, why would I want it otherwise?
Just the other day, there were praying mantises on the screens of the window, seeing them and seeing the eggs hatch, all the different larvae that's around. It just goes on and on and on. It's just lovely.
Wow.
It really is.
And the other thing about your place is that you have a lot of diversity in your beds. You don't have, you might have a few monocultures of things, but mostly you've got polycultures. How does that aspect work for you?
Yeah. It doesn't take long. I think I mentioned the idea of carbon being released into the soil by virtue of root exudates. And when you start recognizing how important carbon is and how deep into the soil you can get it, it quickly becomes obvious that having something growing on the surface of your garden or land or wherever it is a fundamental precept for health. And so I embrace many of the quote unquote weeds that grow in my garden, and I use them as a cover crop strategy throughout the year. First of all, is recognizing that you want to have a cycle throughout the year. You want to make sure throughout any given year, you have a plot of garden space or land that's constantly got something in it. So let's take tomatoes, for instance. In my part of the world, I don't put my tomatoes in the ground until the beginning of June, just because the soil's not warm enough until then. So what are you growing there from March through June? Well, for me, I just let the weeds grow, whatever wants to grow there. And the weeds in my garden are things like violets, dandelions, stinging nettle, garlic, dill, cilantro, kale. And you select the weeds you want to grow in your garden by merely letting them go to seed. And the weeds you don't want in your garden, you don't let them go to seed. And it's pretty well simple as that. So in that tomato bed, I've got all these weeds growing, and they might grow up and grow up, and I might go in and knock them down. I won't pull the roots, but I'll knock down the green on the top to act as that litter on that top layer. Remember, we talked about how important it is having that carbon on the top layer to stimulate and feed the top growth, the active layers of your soil. And then you leave the roots in there, and some of those roots will die and decay and go into the soil, but other of them will keep growing and they'll just continue to grow. And so by the time the beginning of June comes around, I may have knocked that down twice in the course of spring, but I always have something growing there. So these weeds are really helping me out. Then when I plant the tomatoes, I will mulch, and I love mulching with seaweed just because it has all of those minerals that we've talked about in them, as well as being a really great mulch, as well as having silicon and some of the really hard to digest materials in them, the lignans and the chitins and things like that, which is the things that will degrade and create humic type substances in the soil. So that's just a winner. And so then my tomatoes grow, and they'll grow. And by the time my tomatoes are ripe, which is pretty well now here in my part of the world, and I'm eating them, some of those weeds are coming back. The docks are coming back. The nettles coming back. Some of the grasses are coming back, which I don't mind grass in my garden, by the way. I think grass is a wonderful thing. So by the time I'm fully harvesting these tomatoes, the mulch will be matted down and be starting to be assimilated. Some of the weeds will start to grow. And so in the latter part of the season before fall, I've got something growing there still. So that's the kind of idea of using what wants to grow, right? Nature says, I'm growing this here. By the way, it's doing it for a reason, right? That's nature's remineralization program, are the weeds that want to grow in your space. So I'm facilitating that process as well as cultivating my own product in that space.
And you use some of the weeds too as food or medicine, right?
Oh, absolutely. Stinging nettle is one of the most nutritious things that we have to eat in our garden. Dandelions, you can eat all parts of the dandelions. Both of them make excellent fermented plant juices with broad spectrum mineral availability that you can feed to anybody. I love the combination too, because the dandelion has that very long taproot. And by knocking the dandelion off and leaving that root in the ground, you're again feeding carbon down into the depths of the soil. And the nettle has those wonderful root structures that just go and noodle all over the place, which is feeding the top levels of the garden. So now we're starting to talk about the stratification of root structure in a given space for the purpose of adding carbon.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you mentioned something too about nature has its own intelligence. Absolutely. One of the things I used to like to do is walk out into the garden because it knows what needs to grow there. And I would just do a little experiment and just say, okay, what is it that I need? And I would see things in abundance. And I'd say, well, I think that's probably what I should be eating. I just love framing that too with the intelligence of the garden. It knows what it needs. What a concept. What are we thinking that we know? We're going to go and buy this thing in a box or an awful plastic thing because somebody knows better than what's going down there.
Exactly. A real good example is quackgrass. I like using quackgrass as an example because that's something that my garden was full of when I first started down this journey and recognizing it was a weed and quackgrass. And then I recognized that, okay, there's a reason that there's quackgrass growing in this garden. And so rather than taking it out and throwing it away, now I pull it out and I leave it between the rows as a compost pile. So all of these weeds, quote unquote, when I do plant my cultivars, nothing leaves the garden. But one day I thought, well, if this is what nature is trying to grow here, I wonder what's in it. So I harvested the quackgrass and I fermented it. I made a fermented plant juice out of it. And then I analyzed it. And you can see the analysis in the appendix of my book. I think it's also on my online analysis page. It's loaded with trace minerals. And so this is nature harvesting the minerals in the ground into this plant, bringing them to the surface and depositing them in forms that plants can use. So when people say, oh, I've got this weed, it's just taking over, bindweed, quackgrass, whatever it might be, my first response is make a fermented plant juice out of it and do analysis on it. And you may be surprised to find that it's loaded with some of the trace minerals that you might need.
I think that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And you'll often pair that with a soil test, initially soil test. You don't test all the time, but to see what's actually there in fairly easily plant available form, right?
So. Yeah, soil tests. We could spend the hour talking about soil tests. Soil tests are an interesting thing. Doing a soil test will give you some information and it may or may not help, but anyway.
I sort of agree with that. I discovered something interesting about your extracts. I know I have had a lot of questions about garden practices, but I want to get to some of the things that make your approach so wonderful and unique that I was just the plants fermenting and they smelled horrible. And you said something in your book about a little bit of leaf litter. You just go under the top leaves in the woods around your place and just take up that sort of half rotted stuff. You'll see a little mycelium in it. Put that in the top of the bucket. It's reduced the smell. How does that work?
Yeah, that was a great learning for me. And I learned that from Jadam. Jadam is another really great resource, J-A-D-A-M. Jadam took some of the ideas of Master Cho and reduced them still further into very simple ideas. And using leaf mold from the forest is one of them. And in this particular example, the biology that you're actually entering into the bucket is able to consume the products of the anaerobic action in the bucket of water and thereby reducing the smell. And you can take these ideas a step further in using the products that Master Cho talked about in Korean natural farming, the IMO products, the IMO4 specifically, which is using that same leaf mold and processing it a little bit more to digest the anaerobic materials of chicken coops and pigsties, again, all but eliminating waste, but furthermore, transforming that residue into usable products that other animals can either digest or use. So those whole concepts in Korean natural farming and Jadam, I've adopted, and I find them extremely useful in the garden. What you're doing here is you're digesting the products of the anaerobic process. Don't smell them.
Wow.
That makes a big difference because I can't tell you how many buckets of smelly things have been in the back.
I've been doing this for a bunch of years because I learned from Michael Phillips. And as you said, Michael Phillips scratched the surface of what's possible. And that's why we were so excited to find your article in Acres USA and then have you here.
What is good water?
Good water is a great question. So if you have water from a well or a stream or a pond, which is pretty good water, right? One would consider it at least real water.
Right.
It has spent time in those environments and has reacted and may have carbonates, sulfates, bicarbonates, products in them. And what that does is it makes the water hard, if you will, but it also has taken up the sites within that water where other minerals could possibly have been attached. When it rains, the rainwater condenses right up there and falls right down there and is clean and, I'll say, good for the most part. That's about as clean and good as one might get without reverse osmosis or some other crazy expensive and polluting process, right? And so the rainwater I call good water. I think that that is the quintessential good water that is available for most of us. And of course, in nature as well. We all know when it rains, everything explodes, right? And the question is, well, what's really going on? Well, first of all, the rain has the ability to grab on to nutrients because they aren't filled with these carbonates, bicarbonates, sulfates, and things like that, right? They also, they're changing the dynamics in the soil. People talk about anaerobic and aerobic activity as though there's this or that and nothing else in the world. But in fact, that's not true. In my book on page something or other, I talk about facultative bacteria as well as anaerobic and aerobic. And so in the soil, when everything's dry, aerobic activity will proliferate. And things are going along nice and fun and everything's great. And then it rains. Well, what happens? The rain fills up the pores and all of that aerobic stuff dies and becomes available for the soil ecosystem. And the rainwater has an ability to latch onto that and spread it around. And everybody's got water. And there's this huge bloom of food for the ecosystem. And so everything's anaerobic for a bit. And now that slowly dries out and it goes back to aerobic. So you've got this swing that takes place within the soil, and that good water is part of that equation for several different reasons.
Dandelions just come right up after the rain. It's like wonder. It's like, yes, yeah, like, wow. I mean, I love them because I eat them all the time, but it's just, it's amazing. They must be super intelligent.
I hold my rainwater, and we talk about this with people all over the world, and a lot of places have very little water. And so I tell people, look, collect, some places it's illegal to collect rainwater.
Insane.
Talk about that for an hour. I suggest to people to save their rainwater and use that rainwater for foliar spraying, right? Foliar spray, you want as clean water as possible so that the minerals that you're diluting in that rainwater can find sites within that water to hang on to and do their thing when they're spread out. You decrease the efficiency of foliar sprays by as much as 70% or more if you have hard water over like 75 or 100. And so it's this rainwater that makes the foliar spraying so much more efficient. So I tell people, especially people that have a very limited water budget, save your rainwater and use that for foliar spraying.
The little picture that I saw in California, a picture of something that I was doing. I had irrigation tubing and I was using the spring water to irrigate until July and August, when it doesn't rain in California for like 6 months. When the spring went dry, I switched over to my tanks of rainwater and it cleaned out those irrigation tubings. All the minerals were gone because the rainwater could have grabbed those minerals and take them out. Amazing.
That is a great story, Bill.
I thought it was the acidity. I thought its pH of 5.5 was what made it work so well. But what you said about the other waters having a lot of mineral sites already taken really sheds more light. We should probably talk a little bit about the actual extracts you use. How do you vary them during the year?
Absolutely.
So amendments throughout the year. Well, here we are in September. My blueberries have gone by. My peaches have gone by. So this is a great time to feed your fruit plants. And most people don't think about feeding them now, but check it out. They still have vibrant leaves on the plants, and those leaves are going to eventually turn brown or red or whatever and fall off. But now we have the opportunity to feed the root system. And so we can feed the plants now foliar sprays. And I like blueberry fermented plant juice for my blueberries, peach fermented plant juice for my peaches. I also like to add vinegar extractions, specifically oyster shells, to get the calcium and the phosphorus in there. I might use sassafras to get some of the minerals for photosynthesis in there. And I might use shrimp for vinegar extractions to get boron into the plant. But what I'm doing is I really like to feed my fruit trees now because I know that those minerals are going to end up in the root system, right? That's what's happening now. All that energy in the top part of the the plant is being moved into the root system. So I'm building up those reservoirs of minerals for the plant for next spring when everything's going to start blooming. So that's one thing. I'm feeding my potatoes now. At the end of the summer, a lot of things fall apart. And it usually falls apart because of a lack of water or a lack of nutrient. This year here in southern New England, we've got plenty of water. I think we've gotten 12 inches of rain in the last month or something like that. And so there's not really a water problem, but there is a nutrient problem. All of that water is going to wash away many of the free nutrients and the water soluble nutrients like boron and sulfur, for instance. And so this is a really good time to foliar spray your crops that you want to endure into the fall months. So I'm foliar spraying my potatoes because I want them to keep going. I'm foliar spraying my beans, my squash, and of course the flower beds just to maintain good pollination, nectar and flowers and all the things that flower beds have. And the other thing is this is a good time for making fermented plant juices. You can take the leaves that are still there on some plants. Maybe your tomatoes have gone by and you have the leaves and stalks of a tomato plant. You can make fermented plant juice of some of the potatoes you're harvesting, the beans, the squash. All of these things are available now. And of course, you can almost make vinegar extractions any time of year, as long as you have access to shells and bones from a variety of sources and closes in the waste gap. So there's always something to do.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question because a lot of people haven't read your book. Why vinegar?
Vinegar is a really great product. The acidity of vinegar does many things for us in the garden. The first is the weak acids in the vinegar have the ability to break down the bones and the shells and some of the hard things that we might leach minerals from. The other thing is you can make it for free. I mean, vinegar has been a staple of homesteaders forever. One of the reasons Johnny Appleseed went and planting all those apple seeds is because you could get apples. And with apples, you could make vinegar and alcohol, which are really important products for keeping a house clean and sanitary. The other thing that vinegar has to offer is in its acidity, it has a large number of electrons that are available to feed the garden structure. And so that's another big deal.
And you can take your nasty apples with the bugs in them and ferment them.
Exactly. Very, very simple. You could just chop them up, throw them in a crock with rainwater and ignore it for 3 months. And, you know, you come back and there's a mother on the top and you strain it and you're good to go. Actually, it's worth commenting that if you just use apples and rainwater, the acidity of the vinegar that comes out will be a little bit higher, less strong than if you crush the apples up and use the juice for making vinegar extraction. So you can make a more acidic product by crushing the apples like you were going to make cider and press out the liquid. But anyway, the point is that, yeah, and I've talked to people in the world and they say, look, I can't make apple cider vinegar. I don't have any apples around. And I said, well, what do you have? And they start talking about the different fruits they are growing. And I say, well, you can make vinegar out of just about any fruit that has that sugar content in it. If you're in some part of the world where you don't have apples, don't be constrained by that idea of making vinegar from apples.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Thanks. I think that's really helpful.
And now when you do the bones, you cook them, you dehydrate them in some way. What about with shells? The same thing? Or because shells are pretty dry already. Do you cook them to try to break them down?
So there are two reasons why you may want to cook bones and shells. And the first one is to remove the organic matter from the medium. And then the second one is to really get rid of all the water that's in there. You want to make sure that there's no water because that will allow the vinegar to get into those interstitial spaces where the water might be. And so those are the two big deals about cooking them. I use a grill outside because the odoriferousness of the bones cooked inside is pretty rank. So I cook them outside and I'll get my grill up to 350 or something like that. And I might let my bones sit there for an hour, depending on how big they are. Oyster shells, I'll go for 40 minutes or 25, 30, 40 minutes. Shrimp shells, I'll go until they change color from red and then back to white again. And that takes about 30 minutes or more.
All right. So let's go to tools. Let's talk about the refractometer.
A refractometer is a very simple tool. It's been around for over 100 years. It started its debut in the late 1800s as a tool to measure the sugar content of grapes for the wine industry. Nowadays, it's pretty ubiquitous. It's used in many, many industries throughout the world. And it's in the medical industry, beer making, wine making, et cetera, et cetera. And what the refractometer does is it measures the percent sucrose in the liquid that's put on it. The nice thing about a refractometer is there's no batteries, there's no moving parts. It's merely measuring the bending of light as it goes through the sap medium, actually the boundary between the sap medium and the glass. It was calibrated so that one Brix equals 1% sucrose. So the whole device is calibrated so that it measures that percent sucrose. And it's a wonderful way of measuring the efficacy of the foliar spray you're using, the health of the plant in general, for comparing products that you might purchase from various farms and locations. One of the things I do is I measure the refractive index of the tomatoes that I get from various farms. And you can tell an awful lot about the farm and the practices of the farm by those refractive index. As an example, the refractive index range, which was put together by Carrie Reams in the 40s, says that a tomato that's very poor is a 4 and really good, excellent, is a 12. Well, I would argue that most people who listen to this have not tasted a tomato that was higher than 5. Most of the tomatoes that you buy in the grocery store, especially those winter plastic things, they're like 2s and 3s at best. And if you find a farm that's putting out a 5 tomato, then it's probably worth going back there if you're not growing your own, because a 5 is pretty good. So when you start getting tomatoes that Brix at 7 and 8, you're going to taste something entirely different than your general experience might be. So I like the refractometer for many different reasons, and I talk about those different reasons. Today, there's much work being put out to try and develop tools that are more sophisticated than that. Dan's been working on a tool for a while.
Dan Kittredge.
Biometer, and that's coming along. But the amount of effort and data gathering to make the algorithms work is extensive. One of the things that it has revealed so far, Dan's biometer, is that the variation in the health of crops is extreme, orders of magnitude. This agrees with Dr. James Duke's database, the ethnobotanical and phytochemical database that you can view online for free, which lists many different plants and lists the variety of minerals that are in them and the range of minerals that are in them. That's one of the things that I like about the database that I'm putting together, which is listing minerals in plants. It hasn't shown this yet because I don't have enough data. It will, I suggest, also show the wide variation of minerals in different plants, depending on where and how and why and when and who they grow with.
You were talking to us when we were fortunate enough to meet you on your farm. You were talking about when we're making our own extracts, you were saying, well, you could send them to lab or you can send them to me so I can gather the analysis. If a person listening was making their own ferment and extract and decide to send it to you, you're gathering data right now. This is part of a project you're doing, correct?
Yes, it is. And the idea is to submit the, let's say you were going to make a fermentation, dandelion, and you wanted to do analysis and include it on my website. So you could use the form on my website and pay through me this $35, the same price as if you're going through Logan Labs. And then Logan Labs will send the analysis results to you and myself, and then I will include them in the database.
Wonderful, because yeah. I think that there's always a good reason to give people who are doing their own gardening incentives to find out what's going on and to be part of this wonderful project.
And we're speaking with Nigel Palmer, and his website is nigel-palmer.com. Nigel-palmer.com.
The book was published by Chelsea. Yeah.
I felt extremely honored to join the cast of authors at Chelsea Green. That was a real thrill for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So methods to establish new garden beds. How do you do that?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question.
So the classic method of starting a garden when I was a kid was you go get a rototiller and you beat the crap out of the soil and till it all up. And then you wait several days for everything to die. And then you put your seeds in the ground. Maybe you threw some cow manure in there. Well, the disruption to the ecosystem in the garden when you do that is severe. Maybe you can get away with it doing once or twice, because really what you're doing is you're opening up the soil to the air, to oxidation, and mineralization occurs. And mineralization is the decomposition of the products in the soil by microorganisms, which releases carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, but causes minerals to become available to the plant. So when you go and do that, you have a huge bloom of nutrient available to the plants. And so it works, right? It's a really wonderful thing for that one time you do it. But if you continue to do this time after time after time, year after year after year, you are slowly degrading the diversity of biology that's taking place in the soil. So enough about what not to do. The way I employ is I take literally a plot of grass and I might throw some minerals and some biology on it. And then I merely put 9 or 10 inches or 12 inches of hay on it in the fall, let's say in November here in New England. And come May, it's ready to plant. And I often use potatoes as the first thing I plant in this plot. And I'll dig a hole in the soil and the grass, the sod, has become broken down enough by this time, really just falls apart. And so the sod is becoming nutrient for the bed as well. All of those roots and the grass on the top. In fact, I might not mow this area for several months before I put the hay down just to get the green and have that green on the surface as well as the roots in the ground. And so I'll plant potatoes that first year. And of course, if you look at the potato methods that I'm using, that potato method is also going to incorporate many minerals and IMO4, compost, and whatever else might be around into the soil as well. And of course, I have the potatoes at depth. And of course, whatever weeds are growing between the potatoes that survive this process, usually the docks or the dandelions or something with a pretty long taproot, I allow to stay in the garden to continue to nurture those portions of the garden. So that's my preferred method. Another one is solarizing, where you merely put a piece of clear plastic, heaven forbid, on the soil and just let it sit there for a few days to kill the top maybe inch of whatever might be growing there. Let's call it sod. And now you've degraded that so that you can begin to plant right into it. So those are a couple of the real simple ways to do this without rototilling.
You mentioned about your potato planting. And can you tell us a little bit more about the potato planting method that also improves your crops?
Yeah. So whenever I plant anything, anytime I have a year-long program, which I mentioned earlier about the tomato plot, if you will, I always want to make sure that whatever I've done after that year is going to improve that plot of soil. And so potatoes, for instance, I'll dig a hole maybe about a foot deep by a foot wide, maybe a foot and a half, and I'll dig up all that soil and mix it all around. And then I'll throw minerals into it. This year, my mineral choice was a basalt, which is high in paramagnetic material, as well as manganese, crab shells that were crushed up, cooked and crushed up, oyster shells, which are cooked and crushed up. Both of them have broad spectrum minerals associated with them, a handful of IMO4, and a couple of handfuls of compost. So what I'm doing is in that one hole, I'm putting all kinds of things into it. And then I'll drop my potato in there and then I'll fill the hole up as the potatoes grow and then harvest the potatoes. And then after harvest, I'll dig that hole up to harvest those potatoes. And now I have a hole. I'll take the potato plant that goes in there. Oftentimes I cut my stinging nettle that's all over the place and throw that in the hole. More minerals, more IMO4. And so I'm making a little tiny hole that has all of this stuff in it. Now, I space them maybe 1.5, 2 feet apart, and I plant maybe 80 or 100 potatoes for our house for the year. And so I get an area roughly that's maybe 25 by 25 feet that has all of this amendment activity taking place in it. So the following year and subsequent years, the IMO4 biology is starting to take hold. That might take 2 or 3 years. And all those minerals will become assimilated into that area. And so year after year after year, you can tell where I've planted my potatoes because the soil is looser. There's no rocks in it anymore. We grow a lot of rocks here where I live. I don't know about you. Yeah.
And tell our listeners, IMO.
Indigenous microorganisms. This is a Korean natural farming idea where you're actually capturing the local organisms in your area and then proliferating them throughout your growing space. It's just a fascinating idea. Again, Master Chow has brought this to many of us, and his son through Jadam has simplified this by the idea of using the handful of leaf mold in a bucket and things like that.
And your book, The Regenerative Grower's Guide to Garden Amendments by Nigel Palmer, has some instructions on how to do that. There's a four-step process. IMO4 is the final product, right?
So IMO1 is really capturing the local microorganisms in your area. And there's huge variation about capturing this stuff. Elevation makes a difference. Shade or sun makes a difference. What part of the woods, time of year, all of these things. And so I like to have varieties of these biologies in my refrigerator. In fact, some people that look at my refrigerator ask me if it's broken, but that's another. Capture the IMO1 using a box of rice as a medium so that you get this beautiful white fuzz on the top. And then you're going to ferment it. And the fermentation process kind of stabilizes all of that stuff. And the fermentation process is just adding organic brown sugar to it and making IMO2. And this is refrigerator stable. And I have a refrigerator with several different varieties of IMO2 in it so that I can make IMO3 and 4 with either multiple types of biology or a specific type of biology. The other thing that's really cool is considering what you feed the IMO1 when you make IMO2. And this gives the opportunity to make a product that might chow down specific pathogens. For instance, I could take slugs. This is totally experimental, but imagine taking a bunch of slugs from your garden and putting it into the brown sugar when you're making IMO2 so that the biology in IMO1 has the opportunity to proliferate off the eating of slugs. Are you not now making a soil when you make 3 and 4 that has an ability to attack slugs or some other pathogen? So the whole idea of making IMO2 is an amazingly wide open field of research that could be explored. We're all experimental gardeners, by the way.
Right. And I'm curious, though, about the slugs. Now, are you throwing in the live slugs into the brown sugar? And the reason to do that is they're going to ingest the sugar and they're going to make a
Or they're going to get or they're going to get ingested by something.
Dead slugs.
Oh, dead slugs.
And so that the biology gains appetite for slugs.
Oh, interesting experiment. Yes.
And have you done this? Has anyone done this yet? Or are you just in the process?
People have done this. I think Chris Trump maybe exploring these ideas as well. But the whole idea of this process is just absolutely fascinating and has so much potential. And by the way, I consider myself an experimental gardener. And my book is a toolbox of ideas that anybody can grab hold of and become experimental gardeners themselves, using resources available in their backyard. And that's really what it's about. Anyway,
you're an artist. I mean, you know, I'm a painter. I use everything in the paint, everything that goes on. You can say experimental artist. I mean, it's all artistry and it's all experiment. And I love that.
Yeah. So we've got IMO2.
Okay. We've got IMO2.
Local biology. And maybe we'd have the opportunity to tweak the biology in specific ways that may or may not be profound. And so now I'm going to make IMO3. So IMO3 is the practice of taking, in my part of the world, I use organic wheat bran as a medium for this biology to eat and proliferate. And so now I'm mixing the biology with water and wheat bran. And in this process, too, I'll also add many of the mineral amendments that I've made so that I get trace minerals into the mix. One of the things that's really important to understand that a lot of people may not is that the biology in the soil needs the diverse mineral content to be healthy, just like we are. Compost needs mineral diversity in order to make really high-end compost. And so this whole idea of mineralization and minerals for health is not just a human idea. It's a natural nature idea. And so I like to provide the IMO3 mixture with fermented plant juices of nettle, fermented plant juices of dandelion, vinegar extractions of oyster shells, eggshells, to get those trace minerals into the mix as well. And so now I'm building up this fuzz, this giant pile of biology, and it takes about a week, and it's alive and it looks wild and it smells delicious, and animals will come from far away to eat it. They start eating the stuff, and this is stuff that you can actually feed your livestock in order to provide health for the animals in your farm. So now I have this pile of IMO3, this living pile of amazing stuff. Now I'm going to add equal amounts of local soil. And now I can, because this digestion process is initiated, now I can add rock dusts and other hard things, because this whole pile is just happening and will digest just about anything you put in front of it. Wow. Fish and shells and bones and things like that. And I grind them up and add them to this pile in addition to the soil. And again, the bloom occurs and I'm left with this pile of just an amazing product. It's not only living, but also broad spectrum mineral. And this is one of the heart and soul products of Korean natural farming.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. Yeah. And delicious. Can you eat it?
I have tried and eaten many of the products I make. Fermentation products, I feel, are relatively safe because we're relying on a fermentation process, which kills off all but a select amount of biology, which we know what they are. Vinegar extractions. I'll ingest a vinegar extraction. We're talking about vinegar, right? People do this all the time for mineralization. When it comes to the biological products, I will not eat them because I have no idea what is living in these things.
Unleashing a monster.
I don't know what's in there, so no. Ingest IMO.
This sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
I feel like we've been on an incredible journey.
Yeah, we are. We are.
Maybe we can just touch on some of the different amendments. There's the weeds in a bucket with leaf mold on top. And I didn't know this because I used it fairly fresh. You let that sit for a few months, right?
Yeah.
And then it becomes shelf stable?
No. So let's talk really big. There's the weeds in a bucket, which is where most of us start. And that smells terrible. Then you can throw a handful of leaf mold in there and it doesn't smell as bad. And you can also, that will just go and go and go and go. And it will metamorphose over time and change. And I've started to try and get analysis on that sequence, but I haven't published anything like that yet, I don't think. And then you've got the fermented plant juice, and then you've got the vinegar extraction. So let's take these and talk a little bit about them. One of the most important things about them is that the mineral concentrations is different in each of these processes. The leaf in a bucket of water has the lowest concentration of minerals. The adding the leaf mold biology increases the concentration of minerals a little bit, depending on how long they sit. But it's the fermented plant juice that really has the highest concentration of minerals in them. And it's also shelf stable. So if you happen to be lucky enough to have organic brown sugar, then this is my go-to product because I get the extra blueberries that hit the ground that I'm not going to eat, or the tomatoes or the whatever it might be. And I ferment them with organic brown sugar and I have a shelf stable product that I can use in the coming years. So that's really the winner. Vinegar extractions are another kettle of fish. They're another variety. They offer their own benefits. We talked about the value of the electrons in the vinegar, as well as its ability to leach minerals from them. And we can get really high concentrations of specific minerals like calcium and phosphorus and boron and other minerals, not only by the process of vinegar extraction, but the process of subsequent vinegar extractions of the same item. I've actually shown, and you can actually look at the data, you can see that some mineral concentrations actually increase with subsequent vinegar extractions. And the other thing about vinegar extraction is they're shelf stable and they'll hang around for a while. That's a real basic idea of what these things can do for you.
Right. And there are detailed recipes in your book and probably other places online. The Regenerative Grower's Guide to Garden Amendments by Nigel Palmer. The recipes are in there.
Incredible.
I'm going to learn about the brown sugar one because it sounds like I need to make some of that.
And some beautiful photographs and charts. I mean, this is very comprehensive and easy to understand.
And recipes for IMO 1-4 as well.
Yeah. I just love the way this is written. And it took a rocket scientist. No way. It took an aerospace scientist to make it simple for the rest of us.
Maybe. I was learning and it became clear to me that this information was just way too important to just let lie around. And it took me a really long time to gather this information and to find this information. It was not simple. So I started off by writing a recipe book. That's really all I wanted to do was make sure that these recipes were available and throw it out there. But it became clear after I did that, that it needed context. These recipes need context because in order to understand how profound and efficient these things were, one really needed to know a little bit about the soil, about a plant model, about a set of ideas that gave context for why this stuff works and why we do the things we do or don't do in the garden. And so the whole plant model idea came out of that as well. So the book is really a toolbox of ideas for experimental gardeners, a place to start so that you can venture in this experimental world of growing healthy food.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we have, like you have sassafras, we have winged euonymus, which is sort of trying to take over our marginal areas. And it's this vibrant looking. When I read about the vibrant sassafras in your book and how you decided to use that as an amendment, I'm wondering about winged euonymus because a lot of people have it. And I'll see if I can make something, maybe a plant juice extract from that. And listeners might have something in their place that that is rampant, a rampant weed that wants to grow, and they can make something out of that.
Absolutely. Your book has some excellent appendices, one with nutrient analysis of some of the extracts and ferments you've made.
Oh, yeah.
Comparing them with James Duke's leaf analyses, yours are low. I assume this is because in yours, the water was tested well, in his, the leaf itself was tested. Are these both dry matter amounts, that is evaporating all the water?
That's a great question. So the first thing is that if you look at James Duke's database, the first thing is that there's a huge range values of minerals that are in the plants that he's evaluating. So right off the bat, the question is, do the values in this analysis, are they in the range, right? So that would be the first question. The second thing is the analysis process that he's employing is entirely different than what I'm doing. First of all, I'm going through a fermentation or a vinegar extraction process. So I'm leaching out or somehow getting material from those leaves or bones or whatever it might be. And then I'm doing an analysis on that. And so it's no wonder that they might be less. The important thing is the analysis that I'm doing is showing that these minerals are available in the proportions measured and they're in plant available forms. They're available for plants to utilize immediately. So I think that that's a great observation. And I think it's worth spending some more time in looking at that. The other thing that is that the values that I have published, I'm going to call them what we call typical values. In other words, there has not been enough information in order to really determine what the standard deviation or the range of values might be. And obviously, I'm sure anybody can understand that the dandelions grown over there may have an entirely different profile than the dandelions grown over here. And those sorts of research are very interesting by providing the tools, the refractometer to measure things up in front, to the fermentation processes, and then the analysis process. I've given people the tools where they can embark on just about any research program at any level in order to ascertain and understand more information about these things. And one of the things that's really exciting for me is discussing these ideas with universities and other educational institutions to try and promote the idea of experimentation and measurement with people that are interested and young in order to develop these ideas.
I was looking at a few things like copper and boron and phosphorus and a few other things. It seemed like the low end of his range was about 10 times or so more than your values in table E5, fermented plant juice. That was where that question came from.
I really like that observation, Bill. And I stand by my previous conversation is that when we ferment or vinegar extract, we're leaching out only some of the constituents of the plant material rather than analyzing the entire plant material itself.
And I just want to thank you so much for our conversation, for joining us, for sharing your wisdom with us and our listeners. There's so much to talk about. I'm sure there's going to be another conversation up the road when we know more.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity to share these ideas.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you again.
Thank you. Yeah. And it's Nigel Palmer. His wife, Joan, offers 4 series classes, and Nigel offers online, and you teach the garden part. And it's nigel-palmer.com is the website.
Yes.
And there are great videos there, information.
Wonderful, and valuable resource.
Yeah.
Again, we were speaking with Nigel Palmer of the Institute of Sustainable Nutrition. This is WBCRLP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org.